To say that Ginger was flabbergasted would be to express his feelings mildly. He was thunderstruck. The possibility of this development had not occurred to him. Ginger turned to Biggles, who was staring at the oncoming machine with disgust. "He was looking for Sarton, I expect," he muttered. Biggles nodded. "He spotted who we are," he said bitterly. "It'll be interesting to see what he does." The Winkle banked sharply and, putting its nose down, dived at the stranded Jupiter. Biggles let out a warning yell. "Lie flat!" Above the bellow of the Winkle's engines, there came the vicious chatter of a machine gun, and a line of ice splinters and flecks of snow leapt into the air. As it swept past, Ginger clearly saw McBain himself behind the gun, which was thrust through a side window of the control cabin. "Get down!" shouted Biggles, seeing that the Winkle was coming back. This time, as the Winkle hurtled past, the gun was silent. Instead, a small square object crashed down near the Jupiter, bouncing over and over again. A signal light shot from the Winkle, cutting a flaming line through the air, and struck the snow near the object. A sheet of flame leapt upwards. "It's petrol," yelled Biggles. "He's trying to burn the Jupiter!" 2 gallons of petrol make a considerable flame, and the whole scene was bathed in a lurid glow. But it was soon clear that in this case the Jupiter would not be damaged. Owing to the snow, the petrol did not spread far, and the flame was 10 yards from the machine. For the next few seconds, the movements of the Winkle puzzled the watchers on the ground. The plane turned away sharply and began climbing steeply. "I think he's going," said Biggles, rising to his feet. "No, that isn't it," cried Ginger. "Look!" Biggles followed the direction indicated. What he saw made him catch his breath sharply. "It's algae," he muttered hoarsely. Heading straight towards the scene was a rock-heaved freighter, attracted, no doubt, by the signal flare and fire. "I don't think Algy's seen the Winkle," muttered Ginger in a hopeless voice. "He's probably got his eyes fixed on us," returned Biggles tersely. Helpless, they could only stand and watch. The Winkle climbed straight up under the tail of the rock-heed, which was gliding down slowly, looking for a place to land. An arm appeared out of the window, waving, making it obvious that those inside had not the slightest suspicion of danger. The watchers on the ground saw the whole thing clearly. They saw McBain take slow and careful aim, saw the jabbing tongues of flame dance from the muzzle, saw the rock-heed shiver as the burst of fire hit her. The rock-heed dropped the port wing, stalled, came out again, and stalled again, obviously out of control. Then, as if by a miracle, the machine righted itself and turned sluggishly towards them. The reason for this apparent miracle became revealed. Algy was out on the starboard wing, lying flat and clinging to the leading edge, in an attempt to counterbalance the sagging port wing. The rock-heed swept down like a tired bird. The port wing tip sagged again and touched the ground momentarily. The whole machine cartwheeled, flinging algae over and over across the snow. The fuselage tipped up, hanging poised for a moment, then fell back. Movement ceased. The Winkle, its engines roaring triumphantly, swept up into the sky and levelled out, its nose pointing south. Neither Biggles or Ginger paid it any attention as they raced towards the crash machine. "Get Algy! I'll look after Wilkes!" yelled Biggles. His great fear was that the machine would go up in flames. He tore open the cabin door and disappeared inside. Ginger went on to Algy. "Algy, old man, are you badly hurt?" Algy managed to get up on his hands and knees.
"I'm only winded," he stammered.
"Gosh, how's Wilkes? Is he hurt?" By now, Biggles had managed to get Wilkes out of the wreckage. He was sitting nearby, very pale, while Biggles mopped blood from a cut in his forehead. Angus was winding a bandage tightly round his left wrist, which he had sprained slightly. "How's Algy?" Biggles asked as Ginger ran over. "Oh, not bad, apart from being winded." "The snow probably broke his fall," returned Biggles shortly. Algy, his back slightly bent, came limping over to them. "I've had enough of this farthest north stuff. Do you see that skunk McBain shoot us down?" he said bitterly.
"He was having a go at us when you arrived."
"Did he shoot you down too?" asked Algy. "No, Sarton was responsible for that. He's down. Dead. And Chico with him." Briefly, Biggles described all that had transpired since he had left Algy and Smith to repair the damaged rock-heed.
"Well, what are we going to do now?"
asked Wilkes when Biggles had finished recounting his story.
"Looks like we're here for the winter."
"I'm not so sure about that," put in Biggles. "We may have a chance yet. Have you plenty of juice in your tanks?"
50 gallons, I reckon.
Biggles grinned. Then if we mend the hole in our tank and swap the petrol over, we can get back in the Jupiter. We've got a pair of landing skis inside. If we jack up the undercart and put the skis on, we might still do it, if the snow holds off a little longer. Algy sprang to his feet, his stiffness forgotten. Let's get at it, he cried. It's our only chance. Find that bullet hole, Ginger, Biggles ordered. It's a race against time now.
For 3 hours, the airman and Angus worked feverishly, being impeded to no small extent by the cold. Ginger repaired the punctured tank, bemoaning the fact that Smith, an expert metal worker, was not there to help him. Algy explained that he had left Smith at Fort Beaver when they had arrived as arranged in the Rockheed. He was guarding the sheds. At long last it was done, and the transformation of the Jupiter into an airworthy ski plane was complete.
Is there anything at the cabin you'll be wanting? Biggles asked Angus. I take it you'll be coming with us.
Oh, no, man. I'm staying here.
Biggles shrugged his shoulders. All right, you know best what you want to do. We'll taxi you and your stores back to the shack and pick up the transfer. We'll get away before it starts to snow.
Angus cocked an eye heavenward and saw one or two big flakes floating downward languidly.
Eh, no time to waste, he observed dispassionately. Here she comes.
It took them some time to start the cold engines, but a little petrol inserted in the cylinders finally did the trick, and the Jupiter began gliding across the snow towards the cabin. By the time Angus's stores were thrown out, the old man had returned from the shack with the precious transfer and a small sack.
What's that? Yelled Biggles.
Old Moses Poke! Gold! Shouted Angus. He's got a daughter down in Vancouver. Will you find her and give it to her?
All right, shouted Biggles. Stand clear!
A parting wave to the old Scotsman, and the Jupiter swung round and raced across the snow. A moment later it rose slowly into the air, heading south for Moose Creek. Within 10 minutes the snow began to thin, and they caught their first sight of the ground. Shortly afterwards they ran into clear weather, although the landscape was still snow-covered.
Pity we've lost the Rockheed, Biggles remarked. That leaves us only the one machine.
Well, never mind. We've got the transfer, Wilkes reminded him. By the way, what are we going to do about McBain? He tried to murder us.
Yeah, it's hard to know what to do, replied Biggles thoughtfully. Still our word against his. We've got a witness in Angus, but he won't be available now for 6 months. Whatever else happens, McBain will get a shock when we turn up. He thinks we're out of the way for the winter. Possibly for good.
They said no more, for it was obvious that the future was so problematical that it was impossible to make plans with any assurance. The snow on the ground was by now very patchy, and as they approached Moose Creek it died away altogether. Within a few days the snow coming down from the north would bury everything under a deep blanket, but for the present the ground was clear.
There's a chance that the creek will be frozen over, remarked Wilkes. If the ice is safe, they shift the windstocking across to it.
Well, that's better, replied Biggles. I wasn't too happy at trying to put this bus down in a frozen field on a pair of skis.
As the Jupiter circled Moose Creek, they could see that Wilkes's assumption was correct, and that the frozen creek now acted as an aerodrome. Biggles concentrated on putting the Jupiter down on her new type of undercarriage, a landing no different from usual, except that the machine ran a long way before coming to a standstill. There was no sign of McBain's Wankel. Leaving the others to attend to refueling and the replacement of the undercarriage wheels, Biggles walked across to the traffic manager's office. Canwell looked up from his desk as Biggles entered.
Ah, sorry, he said. You're just too late to take the gold to Fort Beaver.
Biggles nodded slowly.
So it's, gone?
Yep, biggest shipment we ever made. I waited as long as I could, but McBain blew in, so I let him take it. He's only been gone about 10 minutes. I'm sorry.
Biggles shrugged. Righto, then. See you later.
He walked slowly to the door, but once outside strode swiftly to the Jupiter.
McBain's got away with the boodle, he said crisply. He's got 10 minutes start, but he'll probably be cruising. If we run on full throttle, we may overhaul him. Get aboard, step on it.
Not until the Jupiter was in the air, soaring southwards on the trail of the Wankel, did Biggles settle down to contemplate the situation. The gold was temporarily in McBain's charge, and if he intended stealing it, this was his opportunity. The more Biggles thought about it, the more he became convinced that, Unless he overtook the Wankel, he would never see McBain or the gold again. Ginger suddenly pushed his way into the cabin. "Starboard!" he yelled. "The Wankel's bearing west!" Biggles did not answer. For a moment or two, his eyes studied the sky, section by section, before they settled on a moving speck, travelling on a southwesterly course at a slightly lower altitude than themselves.
"McBain isn't going to Fort Beaver," Biggles said crisply. "He's leaving it miles to the east."
As he spoke, he brought the Jupiter round to follow the other machine. For an hour, the respective positions of the two machines did not change. Biggles kept at a safe distance, quite satisfied to watch. Eventually, he saw the Wankel start to lose height rapidly. It seemed only a matter of minutes before it would land. Once it was on the ground, with its engines stopped, the noise of the Jupiter would give them away. Biggles' brain raced as he studied the ground intently. It was empty, open prairie, broken only by areas of fir forest. But he noticed that the locality in which the Wankel looked as if it would land was slightly lower than the surrounding ground. It struck him that if he put the Jupiter down behind one of the patches of timber on the higher land, they could see without being seen. He cut the engines, and soon the Jupiter was trundling over some springy turf, the machine screened by a line of spruce and fir trees. The aeroplane had barely come to a standstill before Biggles was out. Ducking low under the drooping fir branches, they saw they were about a mile from the Wankel, which was now standing by a small log cabin. It so happened, however, that the Wankel was between them and the cabin, so although they could see figures moving, they could not see exactly what was going on.
"I should say they're unloading the gold," declared Ginger. "I don't think there's any doubt about that," returned Biggles.
Several minutes passed, during which no more was said. Then, to their surprise, the Wankel's engines roared, and almost before the watchers realized what was happening, the machine had taken off and was racing low over a southeasterly course. The cabin appeared to be deserted.
"Gosh, we'll lose 'em. Come on!"
And suiting the action to the words, Biggles led the mad rush back to the Jupiter.